Hello everyone, before we begin this episode, I just wanted to remind you that during the month of February, The Trail Went Cold is partnering with Season of Justice, a non-profit organization dedicated to helping families shed new light on their unsolved cold cases. We're at the halfway point right now, and we thank you so much for your support thus far, but as a refresher, Season of Justice provides grants to investigative agencies that fund DNA testing and forensic genetic genealogy research to solve cold cases. Since 2020, they have raised over $1 million in grants for more than 140 cold cases in North America, and at the time of this recording, 6 of these cases have been solved. But they need the support of listeners like you, which is why we're asking if you would consider donating this month and help bring victims' families ever so closer to a resolution. So to donate to Season of Justice, please visit the website givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or text TRAIL24 to 53555. We also have a donate button on the Trail Went Cold's website, and you'll also find links and information about this in our show notes and on our social media pages. Like I just mentioned, our campaign with Season of Justice will be lasting the entire month of February, and there will be more reminders on our remaining episodes this month. So thank you very much for your support, and enjoy today's episode. February 13th, 2001, Bogota, New Jersey. The husband of 42-year-old Patricia Viola returns home to discover that she has vanished and left all of her personal belongings behind. Prior to her disappearance, Patricia had been experiencing a lot of stress in her life and hinted to her best friend that she had something very important to get off her chest. 1 year later, a severed foot is found washed up on a beach 45 miles from Patricia's residence. While DNA testing eventually confirms that the foot belongs to Patricia, the rest of her remains are never found, and there is no explanation for how she died. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Werder, and today, we're going to be exploring a case about a missing person who was eventually confirmed to be deceased. The unexplained 2001 death of Patricia Viola. The date of this particular episode's release happens to be February the 14th, so to commemorate the occasion, I thought I would cover a case which took place around Valentine's Day. This particular story was featured on the true crime show Disappeared, and while the victim technically went missing on February the 13th, the episode was titled Missing Valentine. It originally aired in 2011, but at the time, no one realized that a severed foot belonging to Patricia Viola had actually been found 9 years earlier, and it would not be identified via DNA testing until the year after the episode's release. However, since the rest of Pat's remains could not be found, it's never been conclusively determined how she died or why her severed foot wound up at a location 45 miles from her home. Pat was known for being a very devoted housewife and stay-at-home mother to her two children, but there were signs that she was becoming overwhelmed by all the stress and pressure in her life, particularly since her struggles with epilepsy had led to the temporary suspension of her driver's license. The night before she disappeared, Pat attended a party at her best friend's house, where they had a tearful private conversation in which Pat implied that she had something important to say, but she wound up going missing before she could provide any more specific details. What's particularly odd about this case is that even though there were no signs of forced entry at Pat's residence, the burglar alarm had gone off hours before she vanished while she was not at home. When Pat returned, she reset the alarm system before she left again, but no one knows where she was going or what happened to her afterwards. Even though Pat's loved ones have always insisted that she was not suicidal and never would have taken her own life, we cannot completely rule out that possibility given the obvious stress she was experiencing at the time. But on the other hand, that still doesn't explain why her severed foot washed up a great distance away from her home. At this point, you certainly can't rule out the possibility of foul play, so we're going to explore all the different scenarios on this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in archives, which are not available on a regular feed. In addition, I need to announce that this coming Saturday, February the 17th, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. It's taking place at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned at the top of our social media pages. Hope to see you there. So with all that out of the way, let's now delve into the unexplained death of Patricia Viola. Our story begins in 2001 in Bagota, New Jersey, a borough located in Bergen County, only about 5 miles west of New York City, which has a population of around 8,000 people. Our central figure is 42-year-old Patricia Viola, who goes by the name Pat, and lives with her 40-year-old husband Jim Viola, as well as their two children, 13-year-old Christine and 10-year-old Michael. The couple have been married 14 years, and originally met when Jim got a job as an electrical engineer at Honeywell in Teterboro. At the time, Pat was working in the company's personnel department, but after she and Jim had their first child, she decided to become a stay-at-home mother. According to everyone who knows her, Pat is very devoted to her husband and children, and known for going out of her way to make occasions like birthdays and Christmas truly special for her family. She has also spent the past 2 years working as a volunteer librarian at her son's school, Bixby Elementary School, which is only 2 blocks away from her residence on Chestnut Avenue. But by the time the year 2000 rolled around, Pat found herself with a lot of extra responsibilities, which included visiting and caring for her mother-in-law, who wound up being hospitalized due to a serious illness. In addition, Pat's sister-in-law, Donna, experienced a tumultuous breakup with her boyfriend, so Pat offered to allow Donna to move into her family's residence and stay with them until she could get herself back onto her feet. Ever since the age of 12, Pat always struggled with epilepsy, which caused her to experience seizures about once or twice per year. In November of 2000, Pat suffered through a grand mal seizure, which led to her being hospitalized, but while she wound up recovering, her doctor did not believe it would be safe for her to drive, so he recommended the suspension of Pat's license for the next 90 days while he monitored her progress. Unfortunately, this made it extra difficult for Pat to accomplish such tasks as driving her children around, shopping for Christmas presents, and visiting her mother-in-law in the hospital. Pat's stress level seemed to greatly increase, but by the time February of 2001 rolled around, she was hoping for some relief when she got her driver's license back. But unfortunately, when Pat went to visit her doctor for a follow-up appointment on February the 6th, he recommended that her license remain suspended for an additional 90 days. On February the 12th, Pat became increasingly agitated when she discovered that her sister-in-law Donna had left some cigarette burn marks on the guest bedspread. Pat really did not like smoking in her house, but she always did her best to tolerate it, but this made her particularly upset since Donna could have potentially started a fire which endangered her family. Pat shared her concerns with Jim, but ultimately decided that she would not speak to Donna about this until the following day. That evening, Pat and Jim traveled to Brooklyn to attend a party being held by Pat's best friend, Toinette Fazio Markowitz. Sometime after they arrived, Pat asked Toinette to join her in the bedroom for a private conversation, and suddenly broke out into tears. Pat said there was something serious that she wanted to discuss, but when Toinette pressed for more details, Pat told her that the issue was too complex to get into at the moment. However, Pat did ask Toinette if she could cancel an upcoming vacation she had planned so they could instead go away together for a few days in order to talk. Toinette agreed to do this, but became more concerned when Pat cryptically asked her to, quote-unquote, take care of her kids no matter what happens. Unfortunately, Toinette never learned any further details about what was bothering Pat before she left the party. Well, on the morning of February the 13th, after Jim left for work at Honeywell and her children left for school, Pat received a phone call at home from Toinette. Even though Toinette thought Pat sounded tired, she did not address their conversation from the previous night and pretty much just wanted to talk about other things. While attending Toinette's party, Pat had noticed a plush toy monkey which sang and vibrated while inside a cage. Toinette had gotten the monkey as a gag gift for her husband, and since the following day was Valentine's Day, Pat wanted to do the same thing for Jim. Overall, Toinette felt that Pat's conversation with her seemed rushed, and she soon ended the call, but this would turn out to be the last time she ever spoke to her friend. Well, shortly thereafter, Pat decided to confront Donna about the cigarette burns she had left on the bedspread. According to Donna, Pat was extremely angry and started screaming at her, which was very uncharacteristic of Pat's typical behavior. Shortly after 8:30 a.m., Pat left her house to walk 2 blocks to Bixby Elementary School, where she was scheduled to spend the rest of the morning performing her duties as a volunteer librarian. Well, shortly after Pat left, a local security company received a signal that the burglar alarm had gone off at the Biola residence. They attempted to call the house, Jim's workplace, and Pat's cell phone, but since Pat rarely kept her cell phone turned on, they were unable to get a hold of anybody. However, Pat's mother, Lucille Mari, lived near the residence and was listed as a contact, so the company phoned her. Lucille then called the house to check on Pat, but got no answer, and left a worried message on the answering machine. After the Pagoda Police Department were informed about what was going on, officers stopped by the Viola residence to perform a sweep around the exterior of the house and check through the windows, but did not notice anything unusual. We still don't know the exact reason the alarm went off, but it may have been triggered when Pat forgot to completely close the door when she left. Whatever the case, Pat spent the morning working at the school library while all of this was taking place, and while everyone who interacted with Pat felt that she seemed quieter than usual, they did not notice anything wrong with her. Pat left the school at around 11:40 a.m. to walk home, and a crossing guard and a mailman would later recall having seen her. It was established that Pat did arrive at her house because she phoned her mother Lucille to let her know that she received her message on the answering machine and assured her that everything was fine. Lucille would be the last known person to speak with Pat, but according to records from the security company, Pat used the burglar alarm's control panel to perform a reset of the system at 11:11 p.m. But sometime within the next 3 hours, Pat would apparently leave the house for unknown reasons. Jim returned home from work at 4:30, but was surprised to discover that the front door was locked and burglar alarm had been set, forcing him to deactivate it when he went inside. He soon noticed that Pat was not there, but even though her coat was gone, all of her other personal belongings, including her purse, keys, cell phone, and identification, had been left behind. Most concerningly, Pat's epilepsy medication was still there, even though she was required to take her medication twice per day. In addition, a key which the family used to lock the back door of the house and was ordinarily lodged in the deadbolt was now lying on the counter. At this point, the 2 Viola children were at friends' houses, so Jim left to pick them up. He was hoping that Pat would have returned by the time he got back, but when she didn't, he grew even more concerned and started calling around to everyone he knew to see if anyone had any idea where Pat was. For the next several hours, Jim had no success at locating Pat, so shortly before midnight, he finally called the Pagoda Police Department to officially report her missing. An extensive search effort was launched for Pat, which involved police performing door-to-door checks in the surrounding neighborhoods. Since Pat could not drive, investigators also checked buses, taxi logs, and airline logs to try and figure out if she traveled anywhere, but found nothing. A check was performed of all the local hospitals to see if Pat had been treated for another epileptic seizure, but while this came up empty, Jim still wondered if Pat might have suffered from a seizure which caused her to lose her memory and develop amnesia. During the early stages of the investigation, police looked at Jim as a potential suspect, as it turned out he had left work early on the afternoon of February the 13th in order to purchase some Valentine's Day gifts. Since this happened to coincide with the time period when Pat went missing, he was extensively questioned by investigators, but they were able to establish his whereabouts that afternoon and confirm his story. Since Jim was very cooperative and passed a polygraph, he was ultimately ruled out as a suspect. In later interviews, Jim would say that the Valentine's Day gifts that he bought for Pat continued to remain unopened in his living room on the chance that she might return home someday and he could give them to her. While Pat's loved ones insisted that she wasn't suicidal and never would have left her children behind, investigators could not discount that possibility, since Pat had been noticeably stressed and depressed prior to her disappearance. If she wanted to end her life by jumping into a body of water, Pat could have traveled about 5 miles to the George Washington Bridge, which runs over the Hudson River into Manhattan. However, there were no reports of anyone having jumped off the bridge, and no bodies turned up in the river. Pat's friends and family performed their own searches of nearby businesses to see if anyone recalled seeing her. When Toinette went into a nearby pharmacy, she noticed that they were selling the singing monkey in a cage that Pat had wanted to buy Jim for Valentine's Day. Toinette decided to show Pat's photo to the clerk, who said she did recall having recently seen Pat in the store, but could offer no further information. On March the 14th, 1 month after Pat originally went missing, police received a tip from a witness who saw Pat's photo in a newspaper and was certain they had seen her walking down the street in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Even though East Stroudsburg was over 70 miles west of Bogota, the Viola family had recently purchased a timeshare in the nearby unincorporated community of Shawnee. This made Jim hopeful that Pat may have decided to travel to the area in order to get away for a while, but a search of East Stroudsburg failed to find any trace of her. In early 2002, police received a call from an anonymous male who took responsibility for Pat's disappearance, stating, quote, "I killed the old girl." However, when the caller mentioned that he had Pat's driver's license, police suspected the tip was a hoax, since she had left her license behind at her house. The call was traced to Florida, and before he hung up, the man on the phone said he was taking a bus trip to Massachusetts and provided the name of a woman whom he would be traveling with. Well, the authorities coordinated to stop this bus in North Carolina and did find a woman on board with the name the caller had provided. However, it would turn out this woman was being harassed by her ex-boyfriend, who had decided to phone in a false tip and implicate her in a missing persons investigation in order to make her life miserable. The investigation into Pat's disappearance seemed to reach a standstill, so Jim decided to focus his energies on attempting to get a new law passed which would bar law enforcement from refusing to accept missing persons reports. The law would also make it mandatory for investigators to secure DNA samples from missing victims' family members if they were not found within 30 days, and then enter the DNA into national databases for the purposes of cross-checking with DNA from unidentified remains. Well, in March of 2008, Jim's efforts paid off, as a bill named after his wife called Patricia's Law was signed into law by New Jersey Governor John Corzine. Within the next few years, DNA samples were collected from Pat's children and entered into national databases. Tragically, in October 2010, Pat's mother, Lucille Mari, passed away at the age of 88, without ever receiving answers about what happened to her daughter. In October of 2011, Pat's story was featured on an episode of Disappeared titled Missing Valentine. The episode would focus on a potential foul play angle, as it turned out that 3.5 years before Pat went missing, a triple homicide had taken place at the house across the street from a residence on Chestnut Avenue. The residence belonged to a diamond dealer named Rajesh Kalseria, and on October the 23rd, 1997, Kalseria and two of his friends, Ajit Hira and Bhushan Raval, were all shot to death execution style, and over $60,000 worth of cash, diamonds, and jewelry were stolen. However, the crime was solved within 2 days, as it turned out to be a murder-for-hire plot orchestrated by another diamond merchant named Dimpy Patel, who hired two other men named Miguel Suarez and Richard Morales to enter the residence and kill the victims. A fourth suspect named Darwin Godoy functioned as the getaway driver and remained parked outside in their vehicle, but the plan unraveled when an eyewitness from the neighborhood became suspicious of the vehicle and phoned the police. Bogota police officer James Sepp, who would later become the lead investigator on Pat's case, was summoned to the scene and spoke with Darwin Godoy, who shared a false story about having been sent there by his brother to perform an estimate on a garage for an upcoming construction project. At the time, Godoy was carrying three cloned cell phones which were seized by Sepp, who cited Godoy for a pair of traffic violations and took down his information before leaving the scene. Of course, when Sepp learned that a triple homicide had taken place in the same neighborhood, Godoy was immediately tracked down and taken in for questioning. He soon confessed to his involvement in the murder-for-hire plot, which led to the arrests of Patel, Suarez, and Morales. Even though they lived in the same neighborhood, the Viola family did not appear to have any connection to the crime, but investigators were intrigued by the fact that the various trials for the four suspects just happened to be taking place around the same time Pat went missing. In February of 2000, Suarez was in the Bergen County Jail awaiting trial when he started making incriminating statements to other inmates about hiring a hitman to kill witnesses who were scheduled to testify against him. When this information got back to the authorities, an undercover detective went inside the jail and posed as a hitman, and after Suarez attempted to solicit his services to kill someone, he was charged with an additional count of conspiracy to commit murder. This led to speculation that one or more of the defendants may have believed that Pat was an important witness in the case and arranged to have her killed, which is why she ended up going missing. But in the end, no tangible link was found between the two cases, and Patel, Suarez, and Godoy all received life sentences for their roles in the murders, while Morales received a 20-year sentence for conspiracy. Well, at the time the Disappeared episode originally aired, no one realized that one of Pat's remains had already been found. On July the 27th, 2002, 17 months after Pat originally went missing, a left foot clad in a shoe and a sock washed up on Rockaway Beach in Queens. The beach ran alongside the Atlantic Ocean, and the foot was found on a stretch of beach near 123rd Street, approximately 45 miles away from the Biola residence. Even though police performed an extensive search, they were unable to turn up any additional remains for the victim, and the foot was buried in the Potter's Field on Hart Island, which houses the remains for over 1 million unidentified individuals. Years later, DNA samples taken from the foot were entered into the Combined DNA Index System, aka CODIS, and on September the 11th, 2012, it was announced that there was a match to the DNA which had been submitted by Patricia Viola's children. This positively confirmed that the foot belonged to her and that she was deceased. Police soon notified Jim about the match, and in an ironic turn of events, it turned out that he had legally declared Pat dead only 4 days beforehand. Jim subsequently told his daughter Christine about this, but his son Michael was in a medically induced coma at the time since he was battling an infection, and while he made a full recovery, Jim had to hold off on informing him about his mother's death. In February of 2013, the Viola family finally held a funeral service for Pat, in which they were able to bury a small container with the few remains of her they had. Since the rest of Pat's remains could not be found, investigators have been unable to establish an exact cause of death. So after 2 decades, the full circumstances of how Patricia Viola went missing and wound up deceased remain unclear. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So, looking at the history of all the missing persons cases which have been profiled on Disappeared, many of them are still unsolved today, but there have also been a wide variety of resolutions. Some of these cases have been conclusively solved, with the victim's remains being found and a suspect being charged with murder. There are other cases where the remains were recovered, and it was ruled that the victim either died by suicide or exposure. Hell, there have even been a few cases where it turned out that the victim disappeared voluntarily and were still alive somewhere. But then there are those frustrating cases where the victim's remains were found, and no one knows how they died. The Patricia Viola case fits into that category, and is all the more frustrating because all they have is one of her feet. So even though her loved ones now know for certain that she is deceased, there's not enough evidence to conclusively determine if her death was a homicide, suicide, or accidental. This situation is very reminiscent of another case I covered on the podcast last year on episode number 312, and that's the death of Brian Neisenfeld, an 18-year-old university student who vanished in Rhode Island in February of 1997 before his severed foot was found washed up on a beach 7 months later. Much like Patricia Viola, none of Brian's other remains could be found, and while there are compelling arguments to be made from both sides about his death being a homicide or suicide, there was just not enough evidence to know for certain. However, it must be reiterated that just because a victim's severed foot is found does not necessarily mean they were murdered by someone who dismembered them, as decomposition can cause a foot to detach from a victim's body. As another example of this, there's the infamous Salish Sea Feet mystery, where 20 detached human feet, many of them wearing shoes, have been found washed up on the coasts of the Salish Sea in British Columbia and Washington State. The majority of these feet were eventually linked back to victims who wound up in the water, and it was determined that they died via suicide or accident. When a foot detaches from the body while still inside a shoe, much like what happened with Pat and Brian Neisenfeld, that makes it easier for the foot to float away and eventually wash up on shore, even if the rest of the victim's remains are never recovered. So yes, the discovery of Pat's severed foot would not rule out the possibility that her death was a suicide. I've always felt so bad for Pat's family, as it sounds like she was a legitimately great wife and mother, and her husband and children desperately miss her. The Disappeared episode aired 10 years after she originally went missing, and it was pretty heartbreaking to see footage of Pat's daughter Christine getting married and sharing how sad she was that her mother couldn't be around for her wedding. And when Pat's official obituary was published a few years later, it was revealed that she now had some grandchildren whom she never got the opportunity to meet. I know that Jim Viola was initially considered to be a potential suspect since he just happened to leave work early to go shopping on the afternoon Pat went missing, but I can only assume that investigators were able to account for his whereabouts in order to conclusively rule him out. After all, Jim has frequently stated that the Valentine's Day gifts he purchased remained unopened at his residence for years, so they were obviously able to confirm that he purchased them. And of course, Jim was very proactive about searching for Pat and spreading awareness about her case, even going so far as to getting a bill named after her past called Patricia's Law. I suppose it's only appropriate that this bill made it mandatory to collect DNA samples from missing persons' families, because this is what ultimately led to a partial resolution in this case. Remember, Pat's severed foot was originally discovered in 2002, but since it took so long to enter her children's DNA into the appropriate databases, it was not identified for another 10 years. Now, even though Pat's loved ones went out of their way to keep her case in the spotlight while she was missing, I have seen virtually no media coverage at all since her funeral service took place in early 2013. Even though her case technically remains open, I can only assume there have not been any new developments in the investigation into her death for quite some time, so there just isn't anything to report. Pat's friends and family used to be very adamant in their belief that she was not suicidal and never would have left her children behind, even if she was feeling seriously depressed. I know that several years ago, shortly after the identification of Pat's foot, Jim appeared in a thread about this case at the Web Sleuths forum and left some comments in which he seemed very defensive over the idea that people would think that Pat took her own life. Well, with the evidence we have, we obviously can't say with any certainty that her death was a suicide, but the problem is that there's no evidence to prove it wasn't a suicide either. What we do know is that Pat was going through a very stressful time before she disappeared and almost seemed to be on the verge of a mental breakdown. She was pretty overwhelmed by all the responsibilities in her life, and this whole situation was exacerbated by the fact that her epileptic seizures led to her driver's license being suspended for 90 days, and she had recently been informed by her doctor that the suspension would be extended another 3 months. It sounds like Pat still attempted to put on a happy face for her family, but the night before she went missing, she had that private conversation with her friend, Toinette, in which she broke down crying and indicated that something was seriously wrong. Now, on one hand, the fact that she asked Toinette to cancel her planned vacation so they could go somewhere together would not seem to point towards Pat being suicidal. Even if she was having suicidal thoughts, this would indicate that Pat was at least going to attempt to reach out for help from Toinette, who agreed to her request. So why wouldn't Pat have at least waited until after she went on her trip with Toinette? But on the other hand, Pat also asked Toinette to, quote-unquote, take care of her kids no matter what happens, which is a disturbing statement, implying that she may have been planning to end her own life. Of course, that statement could also be construed as Pat believing that her life was in danger and hoping that Toinette would protect her kids if she was killed, but if there was anything going on to suggest that Pat was being targeted for murder, investigators have never found it. Of course, when Toinette phoned Pat the very next morning, Pat pretty much ignored their previous conversation and acted like everything was fine, but maybe by that point, Pat had decided she was going to end things and was at peace with it. Now, if she was planning suicide, it's very unusual that Pat would inquire about buying a singing monkey for her husband as a gag Valentine's gift, since as far as we can tell, she never bought this monkey or stuck around for Valentine's Day. But I've always wondered if there might have been some symbolism over the fact that the singing monkey was inside a cage, as if Pat wanted to tell Jim that all of her responsibilities as a stay-at-home housewife and mother were making her feel like she was trapped inside a cage. We have one witness who thought they saw Pat inside a pharmacy where these monkeys were sold, but once again, we have no evidence that she ever bought one, so this angle may not have any significance to the case. So one aspect of this story which does not appear to have been fully fleshed out is Pat's sister-in-law, Donna, who was staying at the Viola residence at that time in order to recover from a difficult breakup. After her phone call with Toinette, Pat reportedly confronted Donna and had a huge meltdown over the fact that Donna was smoking in the house and had gotten cigarette burns on the bedspread. According to Jim, getting this angry was very out of character for Pat, as he claimed that he never even heard her raise her voice before this. Now, the disappeared episode is the only source I found which mentions this incident with Donna, as she was not interviewed on the show, and I've never seen her mentioned in any news articles about the case. And even though investigators have spoken about how thoroughly they questioned Jim in order to rule him out as a suspect, we've never heard anything about how much Donna was questioned or what kind of alibi she had that day. This has caused some online sleuths to suspect that perhaps Donna may have even been involved in Pat's disappearance, but since this possibility has never been openly pushed forward by law enforcement, I can only assume they were able to account for her whereabouts. As for all we know, maybe she was at work the entire day. It definitely sounds like Donna was no longer at the house when the burglar alarm went off and police stopped by there to perform a check. Now, even if Donna had nothing to do with Pat's disappearance, you could still believe this confrontation was Pat's breaking point, but let's not forget that she spent the next 3 hours performing her work as a volunteer librarian at her son's school, and apparently did not give anyone else there the impression that something was wrong. If Pat was planning suicide, you might be wondering why she would even bother to show up at the school, but sometimes, suicidal people can be very unpredictable, and their actions don't make sense to anyone but themselves. Pat was described as being a very meticulous homemaker when it came to maintaining the household and completing all her familial responsibilities, so she may have just held the mindset that she didn't want to leave the school in the lurch by not showing up as scheduled that day, even though she had planned it to be her last day on Earth. We do know that Pat returned home because she spoke to her mother on the phone and reset the alarm system at 1:11 p.m., but what happened to her afterwards is anyone's guess. Perhaps her decision to end her own life was a completely spur-of-the-moment thing, was just popped into her head during this time period. So there's been some question about whether this burglar alarm which went off while Pat was at the school has any relation to what happened to her. While her family seems to believe that it simply went off because she forgot to close the door all the way, there has been speculation that someone may have attempted to break into the house that morning and then later returned to do something to Pat. But I don't believe they were lying in wait for her to come back, because we know that Pat was at home for at least an hour and a half before she left again, and when she spoke to her mother on the phone, she did not act like anything was out of the ordinary. There were also no signs of forced entry at the residence, and if someone abducted Pat from there, I'm not sure why they would have had to reset the system and activate the alarm. Overall, I am inclined to believe that the situation with the alarm was just a coincidence, and if Pat did not close the door properly, that could be another sign that her mind was elsewhere that day. Now, the only scenario which has been pushed forward as a possible reason for someone wanting Pat dead is the fact that a triple homicide took place at the house directly across the street from the Viola residence in October of 1997. Granted, it is unusual that two separate cases like this would take place so close to each other on the same street in a seemingly safe neighborhood in Magoda, which is not known for having a particularly high crime rate. But I think that trying to link these cases together is a major stretch. Now, it is true that while he was in jail awaiting trial, one of the perpetrators, Miguel Suarez, tried to hire a hitman to kill witnesses who were scheduled to testify against him at trial, but this was an entire year before Pat went missing. And the key word here is testify, as Pat never appeared at any of these trials, so what reason would there be to order a hit on her? The reason this murder plot unraveled is because a witness had called the police to report a suspicious-looking vehicle in the neighborhood, but while I'm not sure who this witness was, their call prompted Officer James Sepp to arrive at the scene and speak directly with the getaway driver, Darwin Godoy. Given that Sepp himself would place Godoy near the site of the homicide, eliminating the witness who phoned in the tip would not make any difference. So unless some major miscommunication occurred and someone killed Pat because they mistook her for another witness from one of the trials, I see no reason to believe her case is connected to this one. So if you discount this whole angle involving the triple homicide, what motive would anyone else have to kill Pat? I guess an alternate possibility is that after leaving her house shortly after 1 p.m., Pat wound up crossing paths with someone who wound up abducting and killing her, but that still doesn't explain why she left the house to begin with. I guess it is possible that Pat may have planned to walk to that nearby pharmacy in order to pick up the singing monkey as Jim's Valentine's gift. If so, I'm not sure why Pat would leave her purse behind, but to be fair, we have no idea if she might have taken some cash out of the purse to make the purchase. But I am inclined to believe that the clerk at the pharmacy may have simply mistaken another woman for Pat, or they saw Pat there on a previous date prior to her disappearance. Even if Pat just wanted to make a quick trip that day, it's odd that she would not take her epilepsy medication with her, considering that she was only 3 months removed from having suffered a terrifying seizure. So leaving the medication behind could be one sign which might point towards Pat having no intention of ever coming back. In fact, I have to wonder if taking this medication may have had a very negative effect on Pat's mood, and caused her to become so anxious and depressed that she eventually reached the point where she contemplated suicide. Of course, since her severed foot was eventually found washed up on a beach, the only method of suicide which would make any sense is if she jumped from a high place into a body of water. However, trying to figure out how she would have traveled to this location is another matter, since she did not have access to a vehicle at this point, and a check of all buses and taxi logs from the area failed to turn up any evidence that Pat traveled anywhere. In fact, other than the sighting of Pat in the pharmacy, and the one from East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, which I'm 100% sure was completely mistaken, it is surprising that there don't appear to be any other witnesses who recall having seen Pat after she left her house that day. While her foot was found 45 miles from her residence, it easily could have floated there from another faraway destination. The most obvious location for a suicide would be the George Washington Bridge, which connects Pagoda to Manhattan and runs over the Hudson River. If the river was flowing south, then theoretically, Pat's foot could have become detached from the rest of her body and reached the Atlantic Ocean and traveled east before it washed up on Rockaway Beach. However, the bridge was about 5 miles east from Pat's residence and would have taken her about 2.5 hours to walk there, and could she have managed to jump from this heavily traveled bridge without anyone seeing anything? Another possibility pushed forward on the Disappeared episode is that Pat could have visited Palisades Interstate Park and jumped from the top of one of the cliffs there into the Hudson River, but that's over 10 miles northeast of her residence. I guess it's also possible that Pat could have jumped into the Hackensack River, which is much closer to her home. The river empties into Newark Bay, which is a back chamber of New York Harbor, but could her foot have floated all the way to the spot where it was found? Overall, I personally lean towards suicide, due largely to Pat's troubled behavior prior to her disappearance, but I certainly don't rule out the idea of homicide either. I guess we also can't completely discount the possibility that Pat died accidentally, but that wouldn't answer the question about why she traveled to a spot near the water to begin with. There isn't any hard evidence pointing towards any particular scenario, because after Pat left her residence, it's almost like she just vanished into thin air. I can understand why this is a major dilemma for Pat's loved ones, because if her death was a suicide, there's no way they can ever know for certain unless the rest of her remains surface someday and they offered more concrete evidence of how she died. In cases like this, I know why a victim's family leans towards a foul play scenario, because while I'm sure it's not comforting to believe there's a killer out there somewhere who's never been caught, at least it would mean there's still a chance of learning the full truth about the victim's death. I hope that Jim and his children have at least attained some peace, because while receiving confirmation that Pat was deceased must have been a traumatic event, I'm sure it would still be a lot worse for them if she was still missing today and they had no idea where she was. But if the police investigation remains open, at least there might be a chance that someone might provide the answer someday. So if you happen to have any information about the death of Patricia Viola, please contact the Bogota Police Department at 201-487-2400. That's 201-487-2400. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. We also wanted to once again remind everyone that during the month of February, The Trail Went Cold is teaming with a non-profit organization called Season of Justice, which raises money for the families of cold case victims by helping spread awareness and attempting to fund such initiatives as DNA testing. If you would like to make a donation to Season of Justice, all the information about them is listed in our show notes and on our social media pages, but you can donate by visiting the link givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or by clicking the donate button on our website or texting trail24 to 53555. That's givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail, or you can text trail24 to 53555, or you can use the donate button on our website. Another reminder we have is that this coming Saturday, February the 17th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. If you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned at the top of our social media pages. Once again, it's taking place this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about a very memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the disappearance of wanted fugitive Randall Utterback, who has not been seen since he broke out of jail nearly 30 years ago. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1984 murder of Morris Davis. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Michelle W., Sean B., and Elizabeth M.W. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another podcast, Mystery Incorporated.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
I'm also excited to announce that The Trail Went Cold will be returning again to the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, which is being held at the Denver Marriott Westminster in Colorado from July the 12th to the 14th. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a discount code for 15% off, so please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com, and the promo code is TRAIL for 15% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Anyway, we've reached that time of year again. Next week will mark a very special occasion for The Trail Went Cold, as our podcast will officially be reaching its 8-year anniversary. And to commemorate the occasion, we will be exploring one of the most famous cases from our podcast's home country of Canada, which will necessitate the release of another 2-part episode. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for part one of our special anniversary edition of The Trail Went Cold.
Bye.